On the phone with us now is Grant Sabatier. He is the author of a book called Financial Freedom, A Proven Path to All the Money You Will Ever Need. Grant, thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, great to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. So I love the subtitle, A Proven Path to All the Money You Will Ever Need. Boy, that's a subtitle that'll help sell books. And it's something that's aspirational for many, many of us. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, they'll never get to that point. What was it in your situation that helped you get to the point where you had that financial confidence and that financial freedom?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, the world tells us to ask the question of how much money will you need for the rest of your life. But the first question needs to be, what kind of life do you want to live? And that's one of the areas where a lot of people believe that they'll never be able to have enough money to last them forever. But in reality, it actually takes a lot less money than most people think. And of course, that doesn't mean that it's easy. But at the core of money are really a set of trade-offs. So you can either, you know, spend money today or you can save it for the future. And one of the things that I figured out at the age of 24 was that every $100 that I was saving, I was buying a week of freedom in the future. And so I started looking at money in units of time instead of just as a method of exchange. And that's one of the things, the biggest myth in the entire sort of money world, personal finance world, is that time is money and money is time. But you can always go out and make more money. You can't get back your time. And so Financial Freedom is really a book about how to make the most of your time first and use money as a way to do that. And so we live in a world that tells us we need $5 million+ to, you know, live on for the rest of our life. But there are so many variables that factor into how much money you're going to need for the rest of your life. The more important question is, like, is money helping you? More important point is money helping you live a life that you love? And so when I did these calculations, I figured out that A, I could live on less money and live a happy life on less money than most people live on, and B, that I needed a lot less money than $5 million in order to last me for the rest of my life, and that if I could save up enough, I actually would need less to quote-unquote retire. And when I say retire, it's just have the ability to not have to work for money. I would need less money at the age of 30 than I would at the age of 65. And so it's really kind of flipping the idea of investing on its head and focusing on making some trade-offs today. So I traded about 5 years of really intense working and saving and living very frugally for hopefully what will amount to 50-plus years of freedom. And so it's just a very different way to look at money. And the more you know yourself and what you enjoy and realize that all of these trade-offs are in your hands, money becomes something that's not abstract and, you know, confusing. It's something that you use ultimately to, you know, buy yourself more time to do the things that you enjoy.
You kind of answered my second question, but all of us go to work and get a paycheck every couple of weeks and want to buy things that make us happy with those paychecks. How do you save money without giving up what makes you happy?
Great question. So the finance world or the personal finance world will tell you to budget, and they'll tell you to cut back on those small purchases, whether it's the latte or the cup of coffee or the beer or the glass of wine or your Netflix subscription. But in reality, those small things in life that we buy, they're often the things that give us the most amount of joy. You know, it's kind of like the joy in the small things of life. And so in reality, why would you budget and cut back on those things that ultimately the small things that are making you happy? And that's the challenge, because the world tells you to do that, and then people start budgeting and they cut back all those things and they're like, gosh, you know, I really miss stopping and getting that cup of coffee at Starbucks. And in the grand scheme of, you know, your life, saving, you know, $4 a day on that coffee, yes, it adds up to, you know, over $1,200 a year but even compounded annually over like a 30-year period, it's not going to be enough to help you retire. And so in reality, you're able to save, or you should be able to save, the most amount of money where you spend the most amount of money. And the average American spends about 70% of their income on housing, transportation, and food. And so in the book, I have a chapter called The Only Budget You'll Ever Need, which is built around the idea of keeping your housing costs as low as possible, whether that's getting a couple of roommates for a while you're young, whether it's, you know, renting out your basement, whether it's moving to, you know, maybe a less sort of trendy neighborhood or a little bit smaller apartment, because you're going to save the most amount of money where you spend the most amount of money. And this isn't a trade-off that you have to make forever. I lived in, you know, a small, while all my friends were living in these like luxury apartments, I lived in a small, modest apartment for 3 years and then invested that difference. And it allowed me to save an additional $800 a month, as opposed to if I would have just cut out the small things, you know, it's just obviously the less money that you save, the less opportunity it has to grow.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things I really like about your book is, you know, don't cut out the things that give you happiness today. That's part of the motivation to keep going. So you have 7 steps in your book. Several of them talk about how to save on expenses, which you've just talked about. Steps 5, 6, and 7 really talk about how to earn money, how to make money, and then how to invest it wisely. Let's talk about that. Your 5th step. Step talks about hacking your 9-to-5 job. What does that mean, and how can the average person do that?
Yeah, and the book is built around the idea that you can only cut back so much, and so there's a limit to how much you can cut back in your life there, before you're, you know, living in a cardboard box. There's not as much of a limit on how much money you can make, and while, you know, making more money is by no means easy, it's never been easier in history because there's access to high quality, low cost investing options. I mean, I've made most of my money through investing just on the phone. You know, things that 20 years ago wouldn't have even been possible, we now have access to. In addition to, back to your question about the hacking your 9-to-5, there's a ton of data out there, market data around what someone with your skills and experience should be getting paid, or what another company would pay you for those skills and experience. And so a majority of Americans, they're underpaid. They believe they deserve a raise, and they actually do, but then they don't negotiate or ask for one. And even though the data is available, they don't quite know the best strategy to get that data or ask for that raise. And so in the book, Hack Your 9-to-5, you know, first, whether you want to launch a company or whatever, however you want to make money, right now, the best thing that you can do with your time is to optimize where you're currently making money. And so you don't want to leave money on the table. And so simply doing the research to figure out what another company would pay you. Most industries, you know, there are recruiters that you don't pay for. You know, they're trying to place you in jobs, and they have a really good sense for what another company would pay you for your skills. Reach out to a few of them, you know, take them out to lunch, have calls. They're going to tell you what you should be getting paid. You know, the reality is, you know, capitalism, companies, you know, they're kind of like little pyramid schemes where the idea is your boss's boss, your company's owner or your shareholders, they're trying to get as much money, pay you as little money for your time as they can. And so advocating for more money. And then the last piece, for most jobs, it costs companies between 40 and 60% of your annual salary just to replace you. And so most employees have so much more leverage to negotiate a raise, but they're afraid to ask for it. You know, we look at our bosses kind of like we looked at our teachers in schools. We're worried that they're going to send us to the principal's office or fire us, when in reality, most employees have a lot more leverage And in the book, there's just a step-by-step strategy for how to analyze what you should be getting paid, how to track when you're going above and beyond your job. That's very important to use when negotiating a raise. And then ultimately, how to ask for and what time to ask for a raise, because a lot of people make the mistake of asking at the wrong time or for not enough money. And so that's really the most important place.
Yeah, so timing and research, knowing your value, is important. You also need to have a reserve, because one of the reasons people are fearful of asking for a raise is they're fearful they might lose their job. And you're in a much better position if you have 6 months or a year's worth of living expenses in the bank when you go to ask for that raise, because if it doesn't happen, if it backfires and you lose your job and you need a couple months to find a replacement job, boy, you really need that reserve. Talk to our audience. You know, there's all these stats, and Grant, I work in the financial services industry as well. I give people financial advice for a living also. Tends to be people later in their lives, people that have amassed some net worth already, and we're talking about how to invest it and how to prepare for retirement. But there's staggering numbers that show what a small percentage of people have enough money in the bank to handle a $500 car repair. So how do people save that first $50,000, that first $100,000, to give them a cushion where they have the freedom and they have the flexibility to do some of these strategies in your book?
Yeah, it all comes down to making some trade-offs in your life. And so financial freedom means something different to almost everyone. You know, it's simply the amount of money that you need to be able to sleep well at night. And for some, that's tons of money. For others, it's less money. The challenge is a lot of people in this country, they are living paycheck to paycheck. And so they spend a lot of their time stressed out about money or worried about getting fired or believing that money is more complicated than it is when, you know, certain people, certainly easier said than done. It might take you, 3 months to save up 6 months of expenses. It could take you 3 years. But the most important thing, if you don't have any money saved, isn't how much money do I need for the rest of my life. It's simply how much money do I need to not be worried about money. And that's often between 6 months and a year of expenses. And it may take you a while to save that up, but, you know, once you get that amount, I can promise you that you're going to feel more control over your life. You're going to feel definitely less stressed around money, and you're going to feel like you have more options, because you do. You're not reliant on getting a paycheck, it does take time. You know, the idea of, cutting back your housing expense, definitely not buying a new car. Buy a used car if you need one at all, the cheapest one that gets you from point A to point B. And all that additional money from your cutting back on your housing expense, or getting some roommates for a while, or moving in with a friend, or even moving back with your parents for a little bit. And the important thing to note here is this doesn't mean you have to do this forever. It's just saying, okay, the next 2 years, I'm going to work on getting enough money so I'm not stressed about money. So cut back on those big things, save and invest the difference, and you're going to have more money than you ever thought possible much quicker. And the key is just to get started. I mean, even $5, $10 here or there, it's going to add up. And once you start seeing that money grow, it's really your choice. Money of anything, we control so few things in our life, but money truly is a pathway to freedom. And that just means, if money's stressing you out, it might take you a while, but just get to that 6 months of expenses point. And I could promise you, I call it breathing room in the book. I promise you, you're going to feel a lot better, and you're going to see things in life that you never saw before, because you're no longer going to be spending all that time that you worried about money. You're going to have more time to maybe spend with your kids or just pursue other opportunities. Very hard in our life when we're kind of stuck and stressed out to get perspective. And so that first step is really, getting that 6 months saved.
We're speaking with Grant Sabatier, the author of Financial Freedom, A Proven Path to All the Money You Will Ever Need. Okay, so we've saved some money now, Grant. How do we invest it? And in every stage of life, if you're 40 or you're 50 or you're 60, how do we know what to invest in?
Yes. So a boring investing strategy is often the best investing strategy. And so the problem with the world is that a lot of the money world is focused on trying to make as much money off you as possible. And so there's so many ways to invest money, but most of them are either A, much too risky, or B, just complete scams. And so you should be investing in historically proven asset classes, which are really stocks, which are, you know, when you buy a stock, you're literally becoming an owner of that company. You're buying a share of ownership in that company. Bonds, which is just basically debt that's going to get repaid and you get interest on it, and then real estate. So stocks, bonds, and real estate are historically the best ways to invest, which means if you do it in the right way, you can get the highest return for the least amount of risk. Of course, there are an infinite number of ways to invest in those three things. But from a stock market perspective, most people who buy and sell stocks, day traders, even active fund managers, they don't even beat the S&P 500, meaning just investing in the entire stock market, U.S. stock market, is you're going to beat 80 to 90% of investors, even people that do it professionally. And it's very, very easy to do that now. It's called a total stock market index fund or ETF or a S&P 500 ETF. And you're basically buying a very small piece of the top 500 or top 2,000, you know, companies in the United States. And so it creates instant diversification. So if one company goes out of business, you know, there's other companies that are picking up the slack. And so over the long term, over the past 100 years, over any 10-year period, the stock market has grown. Yes, it's up 10% one year, down 20% another year, but the average annual compounding is about 7% per year. And when you invest in the total stock market at 7% per year, your money doubles about every 10 years. And so it's very easy to do in your 401k plan, in an IRA, you know, to most companies and firms offer this type of total, like an ability to invest in the total stock market.
Grant, one thing I'd add to that is those 10-year numbers are exciting. And I think when you tell most people that, they're like, oh, yeah, 7% a year, 10 years, I can do that. The piece of advice that I would share with folks is think through the risk as well, because it's not every 10-year period is positive. There are 10-year periods that are negative. Not many, but there are. And think through what you're going to do if you get a negative year. So let's wrap up on the investing side of things. I want to paint a picture for the audience of what your life looks like. So you went and huge kudos to you. You know, you open your book, you talk about being 24 years old, you talk about having lost a job for the second time. You did everything right. You went to the right schools, you did the right profession, you were making a steady income. And you still found yourself with $2 in the bank, living in your parents, and frankly, demotivated and discouraged. You were sleeping until 11 o'clock. You really didn't know what your next move would be. And you went from there to $1 million. You had a goal. You reached your goal. That's hard to do. What does your life look like today? What does it look like for somebody that's been able to save that money? What's an average month look like for you? What's an average day in the life for you?
Yeah, and the answer to that question is there is no average day in the life, and that's the best thing about it. I'm sitting just outside New Orleans on a book tour, meeting people that I never thought I would meet, taking a cross-country road trip with nothing to do today except get to New Orleans and do an event tonight at the New Orleans Public Library. An average day when I'm not on the book tour, typically revolves around you know, waking up, walking my dog, reading, writing, listening to music, going out to concerts, going to art galleries. There's never a single day that's the same. And that's the way that I like it. It doesn't mean I don't sleep in. I still wake up, but I wake up excited because instead of life being like, you know, this sort of thing that I'm chasing in a way or this routine, it feels a lot more like a playground where I wake up and it's like, oh, I'm going to go play in the sandbox today, or I'm going to go over and explore this forest. And so it's not like a linear, always trying to build something, always, I'm not always chasing that next thing. And that's something that, you know, I feel very grateful for. It doesn't mean that I'm not making money or I don't want to make money or I won't make money in the future. It's simply having, you know, if you didn't have to work for money, what would you do with your time? And that's something that you don't even realize what you would do until you kind of get there. And that's the thing as well, because this isn't all about the money. It's more about the time. And there are a lot of people out there that are actually doing pretty well, but they're making a huge trade-off because, you know, they're continuing to trade a lot of their time for money. Maybe they're staying really late at work when in reality, you know, maybe they want to spend more time with their kids and they think they need to save more money to do that. But even transitioning to a part-time job for a while or taking some time off. And the whole point is realizing that time is so much more valuable than money and being able to be honest with yourself that it's almost always easier in life to chase that next thing, whether it's the promotion or the $1 million or the huge raise. It's a little bit more difficult to stop and be like, oh, and what am I doing? Is it making me happy? Am I doing the things that I love? Am I spending time with the people I care about? And so there are a lot of other opportunities beyond just saving enough money for retirement to kind of recalibrate and check in and, you know, don't miss out on those things, whether it's your kids growing up or your friends taking a trip or those things that are going to make you happy, because you can almost always go back and make more money.
Thank you, Grant, very much. We've been talking with Grant Sabatier, the author of Financial Freedom. Grant, we appreciate you taking the time today.